Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to a Brock University scientist known affectionately as Dr. Freeze about coping with winter's weather, how cold it's been. We present part two of our interview with Brock Professor of Epidemiology Brent Fott about his research on concussions in hockey. And we check in with Brock's Research Matters student ambassadors about an online scavenger hunt they're promoting this month. Skating into the crease for some shinny radio, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. So, is it cold enough for you? That seems to be the question throughout much of North America this winter as the cold weather drags on and on and on. Even the groundhog predicted six more weeks of winter on the weekend in some quarters. So as Canadians, how do we deal with it? Other than talking about the weather, which we all do, are we equipped to cope with the cold snaps we've been experiencing since the start of 2014? Brock University scientist and researcher Stephen Chung is a Canadian research chair in environmental ergonomics who studies how cold affects the human body. He also has extensive knowledge on wind chill and its impacts on people. Known affectionately as Dr. Freeze among his research associates, he operates an extreme climate lab at Brock that's unique in North America. So who better to talk about coping with the cold weather than our own Dr. Freeze? When he visited our warm studios this week, I asked if he minds that frigid moniker.
It's actually part of the initiation rite when I arrived here was that our faculty in our department, we kind of each apparently have to pick our own superhero, supervillain name. So it actually worked really well when I was asked for my superhero name. It says, I want to be a villain. I want to be Dr. Freeze. I want to make people uncomfortable. So it worked out very well.
University professors with superhero names.
Yes.
This is a part of Brock University I didn't know anything about.
Yeah, we each decided we were going to have, just like a while back in my lab, just for fun, we had a student who was a student wrestler. So I says, okay, we all need to have World Wrestling Federation supervillain or super wrestler name. So we went with that in my lab for a while too, just to have some fun.
University humor.
Yes.
Well, okay, fair enough. In part of the title, this intrigued me, environmental ergonomics. What are we talking about when we're talking environmental ergonomics?
What we tried to do with that name when I came, I chose that name for the chair position and also for the lab. So the lab that I run is the Environmental Ergonomics Lab, and I chose it for a specific reason, to try to be as non-restrictive and inclusive for my work as possible, knowing that I would branch out beyond just what I started with of temperature regulation, which is my key bread and butter research of how does the body control its temperature in the extreme heat or in the extreme cold, and how does it affect their performance. So I wanted to branch out from just that somewhat narrow niche and to be more inclusive with environmental ergonomics, because coming here I also built a world-class facility for studying low oxygen levels, what happens when we're at high altitude. So that's where the environment comes in, environmental. And then the ergonomics part comes because I feel physiology, even though I was grown up and raised as a physiologist, I felt it was only one small aspect of what happens to humans in the extreme environments. Besides physiology, there's also our behavior, there's also the machines and systems that we design, and ergonomics is the study of human work, of human interaction with the environment around us. So that's why I chose environmental ergonomics, really for a specific reason, to look at humans interacting in a very severe, challenging environment.
Okay, and we're going to talk about some of that over the course of the next few moments. The cold weather lately has been literally on everyone's minds, and this looks to be the winter that we're going to be telling our kids and grandkids about years from now. Ah, this is nothing. You should have been around in the winter of 2014. It was so cold. For you personally, is this the coldest winter you've experienced?
This has been the coldest in a while, although on a day-to-day level of cold, I was probably colder two winters ago because we had a sabbatical from Brock and my family and I moved to Europe for a year and we traveled to different labs. And one of the labs we chose was a lab in Greece. And we figured Greece, January, it'll be nice and warm there. I have never been so consistently cold because the houses there are not designed for winters. And we burned through about 600 euros of heating oil in about a bit over a month. And this was for a tiny, tiny one-bedroom apartment. And nobody there had heat. And it was just ridiculously cold the entire time we were there. And it was a pretty harsh winter. And so that was probably the actual prolonged cold exposure, the worst I've had, but certainly it has been quite uncomfortable this year also.
So what makes the cold so unbearable then? The fact that it is cold, or is it partly it's our mind? We think it's cold and that just makes matters worse.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. It's first off, when we first walk into the cold, if we go out into a minus 15 degree walk outside, or if we go into Costco and we go into the produce section where they have it really cold, we already instantly feel our shoulders hunching up. We feel that little bit of discomfort, and that really comes about because our skin temperature drops very quickly, and our cold response is really tied to our skin temperature, and so that's a very, very rapid response that we get, in a way much more so than if we walk out into a hot environment. We don't tend to be as uncomfortable that quickly as we do if we walk out into the cold. So part of it is the way our temperature sensors are set up. We're set up to really adapt quickly or sense the cold very quickly, and that signal provides a very sharp stimulus to our brain to respond. And the body primarily responds in two ways. When it's cold, it's trying to conserve heat in the body. So the first thing that happens is we constrict or tighten up our blood vessels in our skin, and by doing that, it is really trapping the heat into the deeper parts of our body, and especially in our core and our torso. So if you think about it, we can live without our hands, without our arms, without our legs. We can't live without our heart or our lungs. So the body is really designed to trap heat as much as possible in those torso areas first and foremost. So again, the first thing that happens, the skin is withdrawn into that core and away from your arms and your legs. So they get uncomfortable quite quickly. The second thing that happens if you continue to cool down is you're going to start shivering. And that is the body's strategy to try to generate as much heat as possible to keep its body temperature as constant as it can.
So it's basically trying to heat itself.
It is, yes. It's at the same time of trying to trap the heat and trying to generate as much heat. We can exercise and generate that same heat, and the body is very effective at generating a lot of heat through exercise, but if we're forced to stay in a sitting or we're not doing much activity, the body can generate heat by shivering. And what shivering is doing, it is trying to have your muscles fire as rapidly as possible, but instead of producing useful work like walking, it is just firing in such a random pattern that there's no work going on and all of that energy is being converted to heat. And it's actually quite successful in doing so. You can, compared to just sitting and resting with very intense shivering, you can generate about five times as much heat while you're shivering compared to while sitting. So it's actually a very useful strategy by the body.
Does the body type, is it affected by the cold at all? For example, like a really large person or a very small, compact person, does that affect the change at all?
It does make a huge difference, and that brings up a real question of individual variability. Are there people that are just more sensitive to cold or less sensitive to cold? And it is one of the big challenges when we actually try to apply our work. If the work that we've done with the Coast Guard or search and rescue, if they come to us and say, we have somebody who is in this cold situation, how long do you think they can survive? 5. There are so many factors to put in, and one of them is really body size and body composition. In general, we do know that if somebody has a lot of body fat, it acts as an insulator. So yes, they can generally survive and tolerate cold for much longer than someone who is the same size but is much leaner. And the second thing is, if you have someone who is lean but very big, like a rugby player, compared to somebody who's relatively small like me but also doesn't have a lot of body fat, well, that big muscular rugby player is going to cool down a lot slower than I would. So those are definitely two things, but there's a lot of other factors at play. How well you've been maintaining your energy stores. So if you are malnourished, or if you're fatigued, if you have run out of your carbohydrates in your body, your glycogen, you tend to rely on glycogen and carbohydrates a lot when you shiver. So if you don't have that, if you're already at the end of a long, exhausting trek and you haven't been eating, then you are going to not be able to shiver as well. So there's a lot of real challenges when we take our big overall models and say, in general, we expect so many people to survive for so many hours in this temperature, and try to apply it to you or to me individually. So that's really one of the big challenges in predicting and applying our research.
I remember working with a gentleman, this is way back in the 70s, he was a very large man. And first thing in the morning when he came into work, even in the dead of winter, he would be wearing pants and a short sleeve shirt, and he would carry a windbreaker. Never a winter coat, and he never wore the windbreaker. He only carried it with him.
Right.
And I would look at him and think, how can you do that? But I guess that's basically with his body type, what he was used to.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, again, I tend to be on the smaller side of the scale and minimal body fat, and I can tell you, I hate the cold. I study the cold, but I absolutely hate it. I just much, much prefer being in a hot environment, and probably set the record in my lab for the quickest cooling of any of our subjects that I've had, and I think that's been true in every lab I've been in throughout my career.
Interesting. What about the cardiovascular system or the metabolism? Does the cold affect these aspects of your body, you know?
For the large part, no, in our day-to-day situation. If you were to do something crazy, like do the New Year's Day polar bear jump, where you suddenly fall into very cold water, and that shock of the cold water is going to drive your heart rate really, really high, because you have this fight-or-flight response. And for someone who isn't used to physical activity, who isn't that fit, may have underlying cardiovascular issues. That's the real challenge, is if you suddenly drive your heart rate that high through really quick cold exposure. Just going out for a walk on a cold day isn't going to do it, but we're talking if you're a fisherman, for example, or you're a canoeist who suddenly fall into the cold water, and that's where the big danger may happen with cardiovascular problems. But on a day-to-day level, if you're shoveling snow, it's the old adage, take it easy. Don't try to overstress yourself, both with, you know, throwing out your back, but also just driving your heart rate up too high. Just take it easy and you'll still get it done. Most of the time, cardiovascular issues aren't that big a problem. It becomes a big problem if you are in a survival situation where your core temperature drops a lot and you become very hypothermic, because then your heart is sluggish. It is being stressed because it is cold. It is just like any muscle. It doesn't work as well when it's cold. And also you are trying to pump blood out. Again, a lot of high resistance in your blood vessels. So that's where the stress may happen. And indeed, if you become severely hypothermic, generally what happens that really makes it medically challenging is you have a heart attack. Is your heart is just so sluggish, it's being forced to work against such a high resistance that you're going to have problems that way.
When it comes to the body temperature, how cold then is too cold for your body temperature?
For most people, again, if we're just out and about, you're not really going to get into a hypothermic situation. It really comes down to if you are going to be out for a really long period of time where you may not be exercising, or if you fall into, again, cold water, if you are out lost in the woods, that kind of thing. And the danger really comes when your core temperature, it's normally at about 37 degrees throughout the course of a day and throughout your life. It becomes a danger if it drops really to below 34 24, 33 degrees. And again, there's a really wide range of danger points. But around there, that's when, again, your heart is starting to get really stressed. And you're also starting to run out of energy from shivering because your body's been fighting so long to try to maintain its warmth that it's running out of energy. So yeah, generally around 33 and below, you're starting to be in a danger point. And there's a whole continuum, a range of symptoms that you can look out for. When you first get cold, if you are starting to become hypothermic, you tend to have a lot more difficulty focusing. You can't multitask that well. I know when I get uncomfortable in the cold, I tend to narrow my focus so that you're only thinking of one thing instead of trying to really see the environment around you. And you tend to either, some people get very lethargic, some people get apathetic and just have that don't care anymore attitude. Other people can get really aggressive because, again, they're in this fight or flight response mode where they become really challenged for survival, so to speak. So that's another symptom, mental confusion. So those are some kind of mental symptoms you can look out for. But the other one is really sustained shivering. If you're shivering continuously, intensely, and that's because your body's temperature is starting to cool down and you're trying to fight against it by generating that heat. So those are really clear symptoms. But paradoxically, as long as you're shivering, you're still okay. You are generating a lot of heat. The real danger comes when you stop shivering. That's when you now no longer have that heat being produced in your body and your core's temperature is going to drop a lot faster. But the thing is, that's what we are really concerned about if you can't shiver anymore. And then the next step is, again, if your canoe is falling into the water, things, the other concern is, how do we rewarm you quickly? And is there a safe temperature below which we can't really rewarm you anymore? And that's really challenging to study because our research, by ethics, we're only allowed to take people down to about 35 degrees. And part of it is our history of our research is a very sad history in a way. It was what the Nazis did in Dachau with concentration camp prisoners, where they threw them into very cold water and essentially watched them freeze and die, or took them to very, very cold temperatures and try to rewarm them. And that was really where ethics came from. There was no research ethics before then, and it was horrors like that that drove the worldwide scientific community to have this whole idea of, we need to have research ethics. So I'm very cognizant of that, and I make sure my students are aware of our history too, and that we take really, really heavy care to make sure our subjects are as safe as we can make them and that there really is no risk. But that brings with it challenges. Again, we are only allowed to take people down to 35 degree core temperature, which is really at the upper, if you look in medical textbooks, that's your upper definition of hypothermia. So we're only really able to take them to that very initial stages of hypothermia. And we don't really know what happens below that, except for isolated case studies of, you know, we have a canoeist, we dragged them into the hospital and we found out they were at 32 degrees. And we have that single isolated incident. We don't have that systematic research into those situations. So it makes it very difficult to really say, well, how can we rewarm people safely from these really, really severe situations?
Because you don't have the experience, because you can't.
Yeah, because we don't have the body of evidence. We have these isolated single case studies. We don't have these really controlled studies. And I'm not, certainly not advocating that we need those or want those, but it is a real challenge when we can't study the real danger points where people are at heavy risk.
So with the cold lab that you've got up at Brock, when you're dealing with the cold, what are you trying to find out? Is this find out how the body is reacting to that cold, or what else are you trying to find out?
At my lab at Brock, we have two really big facilities to really manipulate the environment around you, whether it's air or water. So we have a environmental chamber where we can control the temperature from minus 30 degrees Celsius to plus 50 degrees Celsius. We can also control the humidity levels in there and also the oxygen levels. So again, I can simulate altitude at the same time as I can control the temperature. The other setup that we have is an immersion facility a big tank of water that we can control from 8 degrees Celsius up to 45. So most of our studies, what we do is we have people exercising or resting in different temperatures, and then we study their physiology. We study their muscle function, their ability of their heart to kind of control its work, their mental functioning, and we also test a lot of equipment, everything from survival suits to in the dunk tank, in our immersion tank, to different clothing for different companies or different situations and see how effective they are. We've done some work with, for example, with Mark's Work Warehouse to look at some of their clothing and design better, safer clothing for outdoor workers. We've also done work on the other end of the extreme with the Toronto Fire Service, looking at their people working in extreme heat, wearing very thick, bulky clothing that doesn't allow you to really dissipate your heat through sweating. So combination of both understanding the physiology after we manipulate your temperature, get you hot or cold, and also testing it with different systems of clothing and protection on.
But you can handle the upper end of the spectrum as well, the hot.
Yeah.
You're not just dealing with the cold, you're dealing with the heat and how the body adjusts to heat as well.
Yeah, really. My work is kind of split 50-50 in both extreme heat and extreme cold. And I always joke that no one's comfortable in my lab. It's always one extreme or the other. We rarely do anything where it's a nice moderate temperature. Because the other reason we study environmental physiology and temperature is by pushing people to the extreme, we get a better idea of how the body is designed, how it was put together, and how it functions normally. And the analogy I often give is you may have a car and you take it into a garage and you say to the mechanic, it's making this rattling noise, I can't figure it out. And the mechanic puts it up on the stand and say, I can't hear anything. And then you tell him, well, it only happens when I go 60 miles an hour or 100 k an hour. And it's the same kind of idea. By understanding how the body's limits are designed, we get a better idea of how it functions on a day-to-day basis. And that's the real value of our field of kinesiology, of exercise and environmental physiology. We really use exercise or the environment as a tool to push it to its limits to see how it works better or works at rest in a better way.
Over the past couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of videos of people who go out in the extreme cold, like 40 below, with boiling water, and they throw it up in the air and it vaporizes almost instantly.
Mm-hmm.
You're not doing that in the cold weather chamber, are you?
No, although we probably can when we take the chamber down to minus 30. We can probably replicate that in there, but create quite a bit of a mess in my lab too, that my students would have to clean up.
Or on orders of Dr. Freeze.
Yes. Yeah.
Since we've been talking so much about the cold, for you, when you go on vacation, are you willing to go to a cold climate for a break, or you really literally have to get away from it?
No, actually, my main sport is cycling, and I love cycling, and actually part of my favorite part of cycling is cyclocross, which often takes place in the fall and the winter where it may even be snowing or icy. So I do enjoy that in moderation, but where I can control. And my boys and I love snowboarding, and that's our big wintertime activity. So no, I don't always need to go and escape the cold, but I just prefer not to be in it unless I can choose to be in it for fun activities.
But you do embrace the winter.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, since moving to Canada, you have to be just like good old tough Canadians.
Professor Chung, thank you very much for coming in today.
I had a great time. Thank you.
That was Brock scientist and researcher Stephen Chung, Canadian Research Chair in Environmental Ergonomics, also known on campus as Dr. Freeze, on dealing with the cold weather this winter. Last week on Inquisitive Minds, we talked with Dr. Brent Fott, professor of epidemiology at Brock and chair of the Department of Health Sciences, who was recognized by the OCUFA last fall for his work with students in furthering their education. We never did get to talking about his extensive research, so I asked Dr. Fock to come back this week and we could explore some of the interesting work he's doing into concussions, DCD, and other topics. We began with a discussion about concussions, something not just hockey players should be concerned about. I asked Dr. Fott, first of all, what constitutes a concussion?
He used to say it's getting my bell rung. We kind of got a bit more scientific since then, but it's any individual that suffers from trauma to the head, and it ranges from those who become severely disoriented, to those who are completely knocked out, sort of say. And there's a lot of researchers and those who actually are in the game of even just contact sports. It doesn't necessarily be hockey. They want to kind of define it a different way, but I mean, I think the most important thing that we need to keep in mind is that this is a pretty important organ that people carry around here, and we want to protect it as much as possible. And when it gets bruised, it's just like any other organ or part of the body that it takes some time to actually heal, and we need to be cognizant and respectful of that. So there's a number of different rules that we typically follow for those who actually have concussions and suffer from concussion symptoms. With respect to hockey, we want to keep them out of the game, because going back into the game and you're increasing blood flow while you're doing that physical activity is it increases blood flow to the head, and it can provoke symptoms. So following a concussion, we like them to be symptom-free for a week and then to start back being physically active. Not actually playing the game, though. Just riding a bike, going for a run, things like that. And if you can go another week symptom-free while you're being physically active, then the rule is that you're able to go back to the game. But that's just the rules. The bigger challenge is getting the athlete to follow those rules and to report honestly whether they have symptoms or not during that break. So during that week that they're doing nothing, they might actually have mild symptoms. Things that can provoke concussion symptoms are just daylight and things like that that can bring it back on. And if they report headaches and things like that, then that week of rest starts all over again. They need to be a full week of truly symptom-free, and then they can actually start doing physical activity again without doing the actual sport of hockey. And then if they're actually demonstrating symptoms during that week, then the clock starts all over again, and they should really go another full week being without symptoms before they gravitate back in. So it can be a process, right? But you truly need the honesty from the athlete themselves to say that, yeah, I'm feeling good, I'm not having any symptoms. And then when they go back into mild activity, they need to be honest again and saying, I'm not feeling any symptoms. And then they can move back into the sport that they love.
So the main symptom for them would be a headache.
Well, that's probably one of the more popular ones.
Are there others?
Yeah, there's they feel strain on their eyes. They're not sleeping well. They have mood swings, which could come out of the fact that they're not sleeping well. They're not competing in hockey and things like that. So they're all things that we try and check off when those who actually do suffer concussion to any degree. And multiple concussions are not uncommon in athletes, right? You can talk to those who played contact sports or even not even contact sports. I mean, you can be a curler and suffer a concussion because you fall on the ice and you crack your head. You know, the research actually demonstrates that after the first concussion, you are more vulnerable to a second and third concussion much more easier than you were the first time. And so that's why it's actually even more important that you get it right before they go back into play, because if the vulnerability past a first concussion is elevated, then you really need to make sure that your brain is back to normal before you actually go back into competition.
So the athlete really, first and foremost, has to be honest with themselves and the people who are caring for them.
Yes, yeah. You know, it's one thing to say that. It's another when you're the athlete and you actually want to be out there. There was an interesting survey that came out last week, and they surveyed NFL football players, and they said that, you know, if you had a concussion and you were still had symptoms of it, but you were in the Super Bowl, would you actually play the game? And over 80% of them said absolutely. So it's one thing to say you got to be really honest, and it's another thing is that they have such a love for the game that
they're willing to take that chance.
Yeah, they're willing to take that chance. You know, it's interesting that there are those that are suing the NFL because of brain injuries and concussions, but when you see a statistic like over 80% would say, I know the risk, and even if I actually had a concussion, I would still want to play in the biggest game of the year. And I understand that, but at the very end, you're not going to play the game your whole life, and this is your health, and you want to protect your head.
The only head you've got. You've got to protect it.
That's right.
In theory. Now, as we saw with Sidney Crosby with the Pittsburgh Penguins not long ago, and Eric Lindros before him, concussions really are serious business, but why do you think it takes such a high-profile hockey player as a Crosby or a Lindros to drive the point home that you can't take this lightly? You have to take this very seriously, even if you're, like you or I, not a professional sports player, but if you get your bell rung, as it were, it's not something that, oh, well, I'll be okay, I'll go to work tomorrow. You still have to take care of things.
It's unfortunate that they experience concussions throughout their career, but it typically takes a person that people look up to, that they idolize, especially young youth, for them to say, oh, well, I want to be like Sidney Crosby. And Sidney Crosby is a big part of hockey in the world, right? The NHL wants to see him on the ice, not up in the press box. We need to do a better job of concussion awareness and how we actually treat these athletes. Because if we do it right, then Sidney Crosby's back on the ice. And that's what fans like you and I want to see, right? We want to see him. We pay money to really see the Sidney Crosbys. And so they have a real ethical responsibility, the professional leagues, to make sure that they're protecting these athletes, their commodities, right?
Assets.
Yeah. They're the face of the game, but they need to actually be protected while they're on the ice.
And not just pay lip service to it.
Yeah. And, you know, that happens. A lot of decisions are based on money. But it works both ways, too, right? You want him out on the ice, and so you push him back out onto the ice because it sells tickets. But at the same time, maybe financially it's more viable if you do it right and you have them out of the game until they're completely prepared to go back and it's safe enough for them to go back. You can still sell your tickets. You just need to be a little bit more patient.
So, assuming you're not a professional hockey player, if you get a concussion, how would you know, first of all, that's what's happened?
Well, there are those that have mild head trauma and those who have severe. It could be reporting symptoms following a collision that you were disoriented, all the way to you were completely knocked out. It's pretty obvious if you get knocked out on the ice, but it's a little less obvious if, you know, you got your bell rung and you're disoriented and you come back to the bench and then you just sit on the bench. And if no one really saw that you were disoriented when you came back to the bench, it's up to the athlete themselves to turn to the coach and say, you know what, I'm disoriented and I don't think I should go back out there.
But if you're in a home setting, for example, and you really whack your head doing something around the house, that's where any number of us could receive a concussion, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. You should report it because you don't know what's going to evolve after you've banged your head at home and things like that. So other people need to actually be aware of it so they can keep an eye on you. And then you need to take some time aside to rest because you want the brain to heal. So you need to just watch for the symptoms.
The solution with hockey players, and we talked about this after the interview we had last week, some have advocated taking the contact aspect out of hockey at a very early stage. That's not necessarily the best solution to the problem, though, is it?
There's different opinions out there. And there are those that will say that it's the right thing to do. And the research that I did with a number of colleagues, the principal investigator of the research I was involved in was Dr. William Montalpar. He's now out at the University of Prince Edward Island as a research chair there and still does hockey concussion research. And the work that we did on concussions in minor hockey with Dr. Montalpar, it was funded through Hockey Canada and the Ontario Neurotrauma Foundation. And the question at that time, a number of years ago, is whether we should have contact in Adam hockey. And these are 9 and 10-year-olds who are playing at the competitive level. They're the traveling teams, the AAA, the AA, the A's, and teams of that caliber. The question was, should we actually have body contact in there? Eventually, the decision from Hockey Canada was to remove contact from Adam. And as I say, there are those that agree with that decision, and there are those that disagree with that decision. I personally disagreed with that decision, not based on anecdotal evidence or, well, this is the way it was when I was off of the research that we conducted on these Adam hockey players over the years across Ontario.
With the children, it has to come down to the age factor. You can't do it too young, but if you include the contact aspect at some point, I guess there's that delicate balance between putting it too early so that they're susceptible and leaving it too late so that they're unprepared when they go on to further their hockey careers should they choose to.
Body checking is, it's a skill, and it's a skill that is part of the game of hockey. And it's no different than teaching the other important skills of hockey, which are stick handling and passing and shooting and offensive and defensive tactics and things like that. So I assimilated to, in those who chose to leave body checking out, is that when it comes to, let's make a comparison to curriculum, we would never think to focus all of our attention on, let's say, English, geography, history, and then state that although math is valuable, let's hold off on math until children are in grade 5. We wouldn't think of ever doing that because we value math and we think math is an important component of education. So if I bring that now back to hockey, the decision to pull contact out of Adam is that's a skill, but we don't value that skill. And the purpose of body checking, of course, and there's two parts to it, the ability to receive a body check and the ability to give a body check, is to separate the opponent from the puck so you can gain access to that puck and your team can now go on the offense. And in Adam, the decision was that's not important. And I would also argue that there are other ways of separating the opponent from the puck and getting it, but they deemed that the body checking actually wasn't important. And one of the big reasons why I actually felt it was inappropriate to take body checking out of the Adam age level, and we're talking about 9 and 10-year-old boys, it was boys hockey that we were doing the research on, was that when we actually looked at the size of boys playing competitive hockey at the Adam age level, there was no significant difference from within one team or between teams with respect to their height and weight. But there are different maturational changes that take place at different times. Some boys grow very quickly and develop much more quicker than others. And what we found is there was a significant height and weight difference when these boys got to peewee and bantam. And that's an important consideration when you're looking at body checking. I felt that they should have kept body checking in and taught it, just like stick handling and shooting and passing, at the Adam age level, when players are all relatively the same size. But their decision was to not have it in Adam and to introduce it in Pee-wee, when we had actually reported that at Pee-wee, there is a significant difference in the height and weight of these players. So now you're actually being introduced to a new skill at a time when you're now supposed to implement this skill while you're playing a game of hockey. While you're doing it, you're doing it against those who might be significantly smaller than you or those who are significantly bigger than you. And that presents another real challenge. So when you get to Pee-wee, you're not used to body checking. Now they're teaching it. There's a familiarization period that needs to take place. But during that familiarization period, you're playing against players that are significantly different physically than you out there in terms of height and weight. Whereas if you had introduced it at the Adam age level, they're all relatively the same size, and you play Adam for 2 years. So by the time you do get to Pee-wee, where they are larger and heavier or smaller and shorter, you've already had 2 years of developing that skill. And remember, we need to come back and think of it as a skill, no different than shooting and passing and things like that. The other thing that we concluded in our report is we wanted to emphasize the importance of changing the culture of the game and how we actually think about hockey. It probably might be best displayed when you see the Sochi Olympics coming up, is that when you watch the men play, it'll be such a speed game. And there's still going to be physicality in the game, but some of the nonsense of hockey that you typically see, that'll disappear. And body checking will still be present, and it should be. It's part of the game. It's a skill. But the game will be so emphasized in terms of speed and puck possession and things of that nature that the emphasis on the really big hits, it'll be minimized. And people tune in to the Olympics for a number of different reasons. But with respect to Olympic hockey, it's very entertaining. It's a very entertaining few weeks of real pure hockey. And get back to the idea of changing the culture of the game. We noticed in our research that we almost overemphasize the skill of body checking. And you don't see that necessarily in the other skills that are important for hockey. Now, you don't often hear about overemphasizing stick handling or passing or things like that, but it almost that the value of body checking in minor hockey, it was overemphasized. And I'm wondering if that was the case because of glorification of body checking. You know, you see the highlights on TV at night about big hits and things such as Rock'em Sock'em videos.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, that's what they're tuning in for.
Yeah. So the emphasis of the amazing save or highlight goal, they're still there, but it's now actually on the same level as the big hit. And so, I mean, the glorification of that is what children see, and they want to be part of
it. They want to emulate the older players.
Yeah. And I mean, not everybody's going to score the goals, and not everybody has necessarily the talent to be the goal scorer. So even at the minor hockey age level, everybody wants a role on the team. And if my role on the team is not to really score very often, then I want to be engaged. I want to be involved. I want to have a role on this team. And maybe my role becomes the person that plays a physical game. And I don't have any problems with roles on teams either. There's value to it, but I'm really wondering, do we really need to overemphasize the value of body checking, even more so than all the other skills in the game, for the sake of defining roles in children who are 9 and 10, 11 and 12 years of age, rather than just playing hockey, the pure sense of the game, which we all know we enjoy watching, and you'll see it during the Olympics.
Let's talk, before we run out of time here, about FAST, which is the FOT aerobic skating test, which is used worldwide now. Tell me about it.
It's a test that I actually started working on and developing a number of years ago. It's a test of aerobic conditioning, and I was approached a number of years ago by a hockey team to evaluate their fitness levels, and they didn't have the time or the resources to actually come into my lab, and they wanted something done outside of the lab environment. And traditionally, they would do the Leger shuttle run. They call it the beep test. So they're in their running shoes. I need a 20-meter distance, and they run back and forth. But, I mean, running back and forth is really not what hockey players like to do. They want to skate. And so I took the concept of the Leger shuttle run. After having significant conversations with Dr. Luc Leger, who designed the Leger shuttle run, and speaking with him at a scientific conference, I talked to him about developing a similar type of test, but on ice, specific to hockey players. And that's where the idea for the FOD aerobic skating test, or FAST, came about. And it took me a few years to develop the protocol and to collect the data and to validate it. But today, the FAST is used by minor hockey, junior hockey, and professional leagues in the NHL and KHL and a number of European and North American professional leagues. They actually use it as a test to evaluate their aerobic conditioning of their hockey players on the ice.
Was it you who came up with that wonderful acronym, or someone else?
It actually wasn't me. It was a colleague of mine. I didn't actually have a name for the test, and I got an email from a colleague and said, you should call it the FAST and FOD aerobic skating test. So I'm not a big fan of throwing my name out there. But
now, what you find out in that test, can you use that in other areas, or is it primarily just for skating?
it's a baseline measure of what the aerobic conditioning is for each of the hockey players. And it can be used for a number of things. We can use it as a baseline measure of their aerobic fitness, and then we can have them come back several months later after they've done some conditioning to see how much they've actually improved in terms of their aerobic conditioning. And we've not only used it on hockey players, I've actually used it with Hockey Canada. We've done level 3 referees. So we've actually extended it now to not just hockey players, but to referees. And the work that Dr. Montalpar is doing out at the University of Prince Edward Island, one of the studies that we actually did earlier a number of years ago was, is a player more susceptible to concussion because of their conditioning? And so we actually used the FAST to establish a baseline of the player's aerobic conditioning. And then we followed the players over the course of a season to see whether they were more vulnerable to concussion. The challenge with doing that is that you never know when a concussion's going to take place, right? It's a game of hockey so dynamic. So you follow teams every night that they play and nothing happens. And of course, you can't be at every game all the time. And sure enough, the game that your research assistants are not at, then a concussion takes place. But we still have the reported event of a concussion, and we still have their baseline measurements from the FAST. We're able to look at some possible associations there, but nothing concrete at this moment.
Do you skate yourself? With all this talk about skating and hockey and everything, is that something that, for recreation, you would do yourself?
Yeah. Not as much as I used to, but yeah, I enjoy skating. I enjoy playing pickup hockey, and shinny hockey's probably at best is what I do now, but it's fun. Skating is great exercise, and it's a good outing, and I'm going this evening, actually, to Niagara Falls to go skating on their outdoor arena down by the Niagara Falls.
Rink by the Brink.
That's correct.
Excellent. Very good. Are you going to have time to watch the men's hockey or the women's hockey, for that matter, during the Olympics?
I'm going to watch both. The women's game is a great game. They're amazing athletes, and I enjoy the Olympics in general. They're the best of the best athletes in the world, and it only comes every 4 years. So I'll certainly be watching a lot of the sports.
We wish our Canadian athletes well as they head to Sochi, and we wish you well tonight as we speak at the Rink of the Brink. Don't take any unnecessary falls.
No.
Brent, thank you again for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Brent Fott, professor of epidemiology and chair of the Department of Health Sciences at Brock, on some of the research he's been doing on concussions, among other things. By the way, Brent tells me he did have a great time last week skating at the Rink of the Brink in Niagara Falls. Last fall on Inquisitive Minds, we heard from a couple of Research Matters student ambassadors about the latest Research Matters event held in London, Ontario, bringing research to a wider audience beyond the usual university setting. The two Brock Research Matters student ambassadors, Yori Korbanek and Julia Pollock O'Neill, have been busy since then keeping the importance of research front and center at the university and beyond. Recently, Korbanek and Pollock O'Neill held a Research on Tap discussion at Alfie's Trough, wherein each outlined their personal top five. For Korbanek, the top five most beautiful science experiments, and for Pollock O'Neill, the top five choices for the most beautiful works of literature. As well, Yori Korbanek, a doctoral student in physics and president of Brock's Graduate Students Association, and Julia Pollock O'Neill, a doctoral student in interdisciplinary humanities, are currently promoting a virtual scavenger hunt throughout the month of February. So I decided to invite Julia and Yori back into the studio, find out what they've been up to since we last talked, and I asked about their impressions of the Research Matters panel discussion held late last November.
I went to the event and I was actually very impressed with the turnout. The venue, it was at a children's museum, so it was a rather interesting looking venue, but the room was completely filled, and I actually bumped into some researchers from University of Western. Just came to listen to some of the talks because it had to do with some of the work they were doing, and so it seemed to draw a rather diverse crowd of people from the public and also people from other disciplines.
And I hosted a viewing party at Alfie's Trough on campus at Brock, and we had a really interesting crowd as well. Not people from necessarily the same disciplines as the presenters. It was interesting to see how accessible a lot of the research was and how interesting it was to the audience.
So it's kind of cool that you ran into people there since you were on location in London. Jory, what about any Brock connections? Did you run into anyone that had a connection to Brock outside of yourself that was there?
Yeah, it's funny that you asked ask. Actually, one of the presenters who gave a talk on terrorism, I recognized his last name, Professor Dawson. So afterwards, I went up and talked to him, and it turns out that his son actually studies at Brock. He's a PhD student in the Department of Biology, and I know him well. So we had a nice little talk about his son and some funny stories. So it was neat to see some Brock connections.
So you're able to come back with funny stories for your colleague here.
Oh, yeah. I definitely told him about it. He has some funny stories about falling asleep at night, and he left his TV on, and he could hear his dad talking to him. And all of a sudden, he woke up, and he realized that his dad was on TV giving a talk. So I guess he forgot where he was while he was half asleep, and he woke up and realized that his father was on TV.
Now, the next Research Matters event like that, the panel discussion, I believe comes up in the spring, doesn't it?
The next one, I think, is in Thunder Bay. So it's actually held at the old Fort William site. I actually spent some time there in grade four. I'm from Northwestern Ontario. This is at a site that I enjoy spending time at.
And you get the time difference, too, with Thunder Bay.
Yes, yeah. An hour back. Yeah, it's funny you mention that.
Let's talk about the Research on Tap discussion you both held. Again, Alfie's Trough, which seems to be your home away from home. That was back on January the 29th. Where did you come up with the idea for this, and tell me what you were discussing?
To be honest, I don't remember where the idea came from.
I thought you were going to say you didn't remember the event. I was getting a little worried.
No, I definitely remember the event. But yeah, I don't recall exactly whose idea it was to do top fives. But one of the ideas behind Research on Tap is to get people from as many disciplines and backgrounds as we can together to discuss research just in general. So we thought that doing top five experiments and, top five works of literature, that would hopefully cover the greatest base.
And I think people are naturally drawn to lists. It's a nice, simple format. And even in terms of writing our presentations, it was kind of an interesting challenge. I mean, even as a child, like picking my favorite out of things has always been a fun activity. And I can see how people would have been drawn to this event in particular.
Now, when you present a top five or a top whatever list of anything, it's subjective. It's your own choice. And that, of course, means that it's open to discussion. So after you presented your picks, was there any open discussion of your choices afterwards? And hopefully no one came to blows.
Well, my top five, I tried to be as inclusive as I can. So I had a couple people from different disciplines that ranged from earth science. Well, I argued as an earth science person. So there was some debate just on some of the classifications I had. But yeah, there was some comments about some experiments that I had left out, particularly from the physical sciences crowd. So there's a Rutherford Gold Boil experiment that people thought should have been on the list.
And I don't know what that is, but I found in terms of the works I had chosen, most of my comments afterwards were that people were really interested in one particular work, and that's James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, which has always been kind of an enigmatic work. Anyone who picks it up finds that it kind of resembles gibberish, but there's a really interesting way to approach it. And once you have a way in, which I tried to introduce, I think that it's a really exciting work. So a lot of my feedback was really positive, and I found that quite exciting to share my enthusiasm.
The Finnegan's Wake, then, was your number one?
Yes.
Okay. Jory, what was your number one?
I think I kind of broke the rules. How I enumerated them had any bearing on where I placed them. But I think out of the list, the one that impresses me the most was Eratosthenes' measurement of the Earth's circumference. And he did this at around 270 BC using shadows and just some basic information about the layout of Egypt. So knowing the distance between two cities and measuring shadows, he was able to calculate the Earth's circumference to a very high resolution or fairly accurate considering the tools that were being used.
Now, I read when you were describing your choices, you referred to experimental elegance. And I love the term, but I need you to explain it for us. What are you referring to when you're talking about experimental elegance?
I gave two or three examples of modern experiments that required an enormous amount of manpower or person power, an enormous amount of machinery and level of detail. And the elegance that I'm talking about is using very simple tools and in the simplest way answer the question that you're asking. And I have this kind of romantic ideal of natural scientists or natural philosophers or people people in the 19th century sitting in their basement, this sort of gentlemanly pursuit of doing experiments. So that's the kind of elegance that I was looking for, is a simplification rather than making things complicated.
Now, Julia, I didn't realize in your formative years they were spent up in Whitehorse.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
Now, given the fact that you're so into literature, was being up there a help or a hindrance? And by that I mean you would have had perhaps more time than others to be able to immerse yourself in literature, but how accessible was it to you? Because presumably the internet wouldn't have been nearly as wide-ranging back then, so you've got the library and you've got your books at home. So how was it for you to feed your passion up there?
That's actually a really good point, because it's something that I hearken back to when I'm thinking of how I read now, and it was nice to not be interrupted by the internet, and that was more because of the time frame rather than the location necessarily. And yeah, I remember even going for hikes with a book and sitting and reading and being uninterrupted in the wilderness with my book, as romantic as that sounds. It's still a really wild part of the country. And I did spend a lot of time reading, and I think that it was very formative to my research now.
Now, let's talk about what's coming up in February, because you're both involved in another research promotion project. You're always promoting research, which is wonderful. And it's an online scavenger hunt. So tell me about it. How does it work?
So if you go onto the Research Matters website, you can sign up, and there's going to be a clue that's released daily that's going to ask you about research that's happening across Ontario. So essentially, you have to go and figure out what the clue is asking, and you can punch in the answer. And every time you answer, you're entered into a daily draw. And in addition, there's also 5 grand prizes for students that have a active student number in an Ontario university. The grand prize for the students, I think, is $500. So there's 5 prizes of $500. And then the daily prizes for just anyone who's entering is just a gift bag with some cool swag.
So how is it being funded? You're not paying this out of your own pocket, I presume.
No, I think a couple of moths would fly out of my pocket, probably.
I don't have a university number, but I could still, if I chose to, go on the scavenger hunt myself. I just wouldn't be eligible for any of the prizes.
The target audience, I think, in the end, is the general public. So yeah, it's totally open to anybody. And I think anyone who's not a current student still can get the swag. It's just the prize money is only available for current students.
Okay, I got you. Now, this takes place over several universities throughout the province. How many universities are we looking at?
It's 21 universities.
21 universities, including obviously Brock.
Yeah.
So this is on during the month of February, and every day, is it Monday to Friday, or is it 7 days a week that you'll get a clue?
I believe it's 7 days a week, because otherwise the dates I don't think would work out.
So the online scavenger hunt is on now. Should we give out any past clues to give anybody an idea what they're up against?
One of the clues is asking for an acronym. So the acronym is SPLAS, and it's something that's being developed at the University of Waterloo to look at water quality. The question is, what does PL stand for in the acronym? And the answer is plasmon. These are the types of things that we're asking people to do.
I was going to give that answer, actually. Now, both of you are so enthusiastic about research and how it affects all of our lives on a daily basis. Will research in some form or another be your life's work beyond university, do you think, both of you?
Absolutely. It's interesting to realize that it's been part of my life's work even before graduate school, but it will definitely be something that I keep up, especially the style of research that I do in the humanities.
Yeah, I agree. The catchphrase for this scavenger hunt or for the Research Matters, or one of the catchphrases, is stay curious. And I think that's something that I will continue to do.
Or as we say on this program, always have an inquisitive mind. Jory and Julia, thank you both very much for coming in. I'm going to go online and see, just for my own interest, how many I can get for the remainder of the month of February. Probably less than one. I may even surprise myself. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
There we heard from Brock's Research Matters student ambassadors, Jory Korbanek and Julia Pollock-O'Neill, about what else research matters, and a virtual scavenger hunt running throughout the month of February. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk at cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. Thank you.